Welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim. Join host Dan Melnick and Qasim Masood as they explore big ideas, limitless possibilities, and engage with visionaries, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders who dare to dream big. Get inspired, motivated, and find practical tips for personal growth. Think big, dream bigger, and ignite your potential.
All right, welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim. So if you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, tell us where you live and what you do for a living.
Hi, nice to meet you. So my name is Itai Fuller, and I currently live in Israel, although right now I'm in Greece. And what I do for a living, I'm an entrepreneur, mentor, a coach, and a consultant.
Awesome. So can you just talk more about your entrepreneurship? So what kind of business did you start and what made you want to get into entrepreneurship in the first place?
It's a great question. I guess my entrepreneurship journey started when I was in high school, and I'm talking about back in like 2002 when the internet wasn't the first or anybody used the internet back then. I in my high school days, I just started doing like I teach people within my high school. It's like kind of like a tutoring. And when I saw that I keep bringing more and more people, my uncle had like some kind of an office or a room in his office. So I took this room from him and I started bringing college students to teach. And I almost opened like a school of tutoring. And I'm talking when I was like in the 11th grade or 10th grade, something in that nature. That was like my first experience. Of course, afterwards, I was in the military and I started working in different positions when I was older and when I moved to the US back in 2007. So I always wanted and I always knew that's where I want to be. And I guess in 2013, I was back then a director in a big fashion company. And I decided to, with my co-founder, to quit our job, take all of our saving and kind of like try to open a startup when startup wasn't the mainstream. I'm talking about 10, 11 years ago. And this is kind of like, I almost waited for this to do it again. And I took a lot of risk, like middle of the career to do it. But I guess my passion is always was for creation and call it the 0 to 1. So it was a matter of time.
Awesome. So can you just talk more about that startup right in 2013? Because as you said, obviously for anybody to go and quit their job, it's a big risk. So what did you guys actually do? And like what made it seem like that was the right move at the time in 2013?
Yeah, I mean, right move. There is no right move in entrepreneurship. It's a pile of risk. And I guess everybody that's going to either turn or will turn to entrepreneurship need to understand this is, you need to embrace the uncertainty. And if you think anything is certain, you're wrong. So either you love it or you don't. Some people don't, and I'm not judging. There is no good or bad. But if you decided to go to entrepreneurship, you need to embrace the change, the stress, the unknown. And for us, I guess the biggest thing was we tried to solve our own problem. So it's not like we were looking something to do, and it was me and my friend. And back then we met like once a week in Bryant Park, because we lived in Manhattan. It's we walked close by, so we met every week for like lunch. And we were like early adopters back then. It was the beginning era of the on-demand, you know, the started of Uber, Airbnb, you know, DoorDash, Seamless, all those different on-demand services. And we were very much early adopters in a lot of stuff. We didn't come from a startup background or anything like that, but we had a big problem with laundry, as funny as it sounds, especially in Manhattan, where 85% of the apartment doesn't have washer and dryer within the unit. So it was a nightmare to do. And even with the current solution, like each of us waste a lot of energy and time. So after talking for a while, we said, okay, let's research it a bit. So we took weekends while we're still in a full-time job, and both of us were director level. I want you to understand, like managing 14, 15 people, making a nice six-figure job. And we wanted to solve our own problem. And then we travel around on the weekend of like hundreds, if not thousands of laundromats and cleaners, learn more and more about how is the industry and what's going on there. And then we felt like it's almost like a mission for us to solve it. After a few months of research and I just at that moment, I remember I just read, it was just out, the book of Eric Ries of The Lean Startup. So it was just out, like you know, not a lot of people knew it. And I read it and I said, okay, let's practice it. So we did this lean kind of a methodology of taking friends of friends, doing interview, learning more about the problem. Although we were the customers, we still wanted to understand a lot more. I guess after few researches, and we found the third co-founder, which was the technical co-founder, and we start like developing some kind of, we call it an MVP, something super basic. And we felt like we have a lot of interest in our life now, you know, and we did it while working full time. And then we decided, okay, we want to give it a try. And we decided on a date a month away from us, kind of, I think it was even in 2012, in July, I think. We said, okay, by end of July, we're all giving our notice. And we decided it, and we just did. Each one put his own money in. We opened a company, an LLC. Each one put his own money. So we had like a bank account and a budget, you can call it. And of course, no salary. So just expenses that we'll do. And then we said, okay, let's quit and do it full time. And that's kind of where we started. And our mission and vision was, can we solve our own problem, which was basically a time problem, a convenient problem, not necessarily a cleaning or laundry problem. And that's important to understand what is the pain you're trying to solve, because the pain for someone is that's kind of like when we learned about product and startup, like a pain is a consensus, right? Like the solution is one way to solve the pain. And kind of we realized that the pain for us, like we can do laundry by walking to the laundromat or order a delivery or whatever it is. But the time we're spending and the whole process for busy professionals, it was too much. And kind of that closed it together to go ahead. And we went to like a very long journey, I would say.
So was it like a two-sided marketplace? Like what was the solution? Like what did that look like?
Yeah, that's a good question. So no, it wasn't a marketplace. To be honest, it's funny, is at the beginning, my co-founder really like Seamless. I don't know if you know about Grabhub, Seamless. They were like right in their heart, like their hype. And he really wanted to do it. Hey, let's do something similar just for laundry. And I told him, look, laundry, it's more of like the Uber model, right? Like you don't want to, oh, today I want to choose either Chinese or Italian. You always want your laundry the same way, in a more concise way, right? So then we decided, okay, it cannot be the Seamless. It can be more of the Uber model, if we call it. And then at the beginning, we thought about how to make it for the customers. So eventually we created an app where a customer can come in, order their laundry, and a delivery person will come to you within our time frame. So 6 to 7 or whatever. It was early in the morning, late in the evening, 7 days a week. And you're getting the laundry and dry cleaning folded and clean within 24 hours. So the concept is, how can you do less and get everything that, and of course, everything we built is towards it. But behind the scene, we actually needed to build a huge operation technology system, because we have the drivers with the delivery app for them and how to do dispatching to all of those orders. And we have the cleaning side, because at the beginning we use local laundromats. And as we grow, we open a warehouses of our own and we use third-party wholesalers to bring. So it become more complicated, but every time, or the question in mind always is, can we actually save our promised value proposition, which is 2-3 hours a week by, and I remember our tagline was, do what you love, we get your laundry. So we always talked about like the time value that we're saving for people, not the cleaning aspect of it.
Awesome. So was it only in New York or nationwide? I mean, because I think that you sold the company, correct?
So for the first question, we started with a few zip codes in New York, right when we started, Upper West Side, that's where I live. But we kept growing it to all of the city, to Brooklyn too. Then we went to San Francisco, LA, Washington, DC, Jersey, a lot of other places. In 2020, we actually merged the company. So that was a successfully merger for us, where we merged it with a strategic partner that has the, I would say it was a vertical integration for us, that our company had factories of dry cleaning and laundry, plus a lot of drop-off stores within New Jersey and New York. And we brought the technology and all the system behind it. So it was great for us. And this was in the beginning of 2020. So roughly 8 years of running this company. That's what we had, 3 founder, and then in our peak, we got to even 400 employees. So it was a wild journey. And throughout this journey, we went to Y Combinator, which was an amazing experience. And we raised a little over $20 million dollars through this thing. And we got to tens of millions of dollars a year in revenue. So it was a big operation out of like an idea to solve our own problem, the two founders in the beginning.
So did you exit completely, or are you still involved with the company? Like, what is your current role today?
Yeah, so the company is, so me personally, I'm on the board of directors. I'm not an active employee since 2020, in the last 4 years. I do have nice amount of shares still. The company is profitable right now. We actually did, like, because of COVID, which changed the game also for us, because it was a period where there's not a lot of people going to work, right? Like, there's not a lot of laundry and dry cleaning to be done. We survived that period. Now we're profitable as a company. We raised a little bit more money to buy more companies. So we start some acquisitions. And I think so far we bought 5 or 6 companies. Some in the home cleaning. So we got into home cleaning as well. And some in, we even bought right now a company in London. So we went international even. So I meet them on the board of the every quarter. So the goal is like to keep growing the top line and improve some stuff and hopefully sell it within the next year or so for a private equity or a big company.
For sure. So in terms of scalability, obviously now in 2023, you know, everybody's looking at the best use case for things like AI. So does AI have a use case in the laundry business? And if so, what could you see that possibly being?
So I guess when I left 2020, AI wasn't the main thing. Although I since then, like 4 or 5 months ago, me and a partner of mine, we have a lot of digital assets and we're buying and we're doing, and we actually build a product called 2slash.ai, the number 2 and slash. This is a tool, a short content writing assistant tool that based on AI. So I definitely understand more about the AI, I would say. So to be honest, the only way to improve, because we did something that is super physical, you know, you actually need to clean the laundry. The majority of stuff that we did with AI, and we actually use AI even back then, was primarily in terms of the operation. So in terms of predicting the, that was more of a machine learning, but also AI, predicting the orders. So we know how many driver to stack in a certain given time, how to do the right routing based on a lot of information we got. So we collect, so a driver collect everything from the moment they park until they actually picked up and things from that nature. So we're able to calculate and predict, okay, how long that thing is going to happen. So, and the money we did was from operational excellence, right? So that gave us leverage. And in terms of the warehouse itself also, it gave us a lot of a prediction, how many spots will be open, available, and things from that nature. And it was primarily for those things. And if you're asking me, first, laundry and dry cleaning would not disappear. Like technology, it's not like tomorrow someone can change it. The consumption is different, but I guess the AI will probably be on the operational side. Because it's all about like labor costs. So if I can know how to staff correctly, use their time correctly, predict correctly, that level can give you a lot more, I would say, profit versus the old way where it was pen and paper or just randomly shifts, right? There is no flexibility with that to make more out of this challenging time.
For sure. So I mean, you mentioned that the goal is obviously to get acquired by private equity. So what is the biggest challenge between, you know, this now, the current, you know, company status versus getting to your goal of being acquired? Like, what's, I guess, like in the way of, you know, achieving that?
Yeah. So I guess the way I see it is the world is changing fast, right? So in order to create any acquisition, right, you need to create some kind of FOMO, right? Fear of missing out. And you have to create a momentum going. In our case, you know, we were in a certain revenue before COVID and boom, COVID hit. And we closed the deal on January 20 and COVID hit March 30, whatever it is. And it changed the role, like it changed things for us. Thank God we had the operational, like the business that were merged with us it was great for them because we had the operational, I would say, delivery infrastructure. But in this case, when you're trying to make it, like to get acquired or to sell your company, the biggest challenge is how do you create a momentum? So, and you need to bet on things, right? Like, let's say we are betting on M&As, saying, okay, we can buy cheaply and with our technology, with these things, we can grow to every place in the US and do a lot of different things, which is great. Then you need to make sure that, okay, is it actually happen? Okay, maybe now businesses are more expensive or cheaper, whatever it is. So you need to create a momentum for a short period, not a short, but I'm saying medium period of time in order to create interest. And that's the hardest thing. And by the way, it's similar when you're raising money, right? Like when you raise money from investors, you need to create some kind of, I would say, leverage in order for them to have fear and of missing out and actually want to give you the right valuation and the right terms to make it more make sense, to make more sense for you to get their money.
So what kind of valuation, Nick, are you looking for from these private equity?
So it all depends on where we can grow it. Valuation is very dependent on the industry you are at, the type of business you are at, type of, because I would say software, the reason why it's scaling in terms of valuation is because it's the profit margins are big versus anything that is physical when the and also the percentage of growth is much different, right? Because if you can scale easily globally with something versus you actually need to have operation on the ground for something, it's different. It's hard for me to say because, like I said, it's changing in times, and now we actually doing a move building some technology-wise that we can actually license or give it away. And that will probably help us increase the valuation. But I guess for the audience, those that either has a small company or a bigger company, the moment you're putting a technology into it or some kind of a SaaS model or some kind of a way to have to grow the subscription or to grow some predicted revenue with a high profit margin, then you can change the narrative of talking about multiples, right? Like if a small business is talking about 3 to 5 multiple, like, you know, a SaaS can have 20 times multiple. It depends on percentage of growth and the percentage of revenue. So, profit. So that's kind of how I would think about it. I can't disclose a lot of the stuff because, you know, it's but that's the mindset of how to think about it.
So is it only B2C or is it B2B? Like, are you working with companies? Like, what are your kind of customers look like?
So I would say primarily B2C. However, we do have partnership with either gyms or big corporations that had a lot of things to clean, because we do have like trucks and things from that nature. We also work with the B2B with the office cleaning, not just home cleaning, but office cleaning. So that definitely boosting the revenue. But like I said, it's at the end of the day, you're doing something physical. Doesn't matter if it's a B2B or B2C. And that's the biggest challenge. And this is why we're trying to put some technology now into sell the technology itself, for example, for other cleaners or for other places around the US to make us more attractive in terms of selling our software, which operates well.
For sure. So in terms of the software, like how do you even get the word out? Because, you know, I think that, you know, obviously many people, I'm sure, could use a solution, but they don't even know that, you know, it exists. So how do you get the word out? Like how do you go about acquiring new customers?
So from if you're talking about the new way, what I told you about the technology, or you're talking about in general, the B2C?
Just both.
So from the B2C business, a lot of it was referral at the early days. The first 3 or 4 years, we got, I think, 70% of came from a code of their friends because they were happy about the service. They wanted to brag about it. And we did give them, like, whoever refer, you can get some money. So that was a great, I would say, acceleration tool for us. As you grow and then you go to other markets, it's usually what worked best for us is doing cross platforms. So we did some of the paid acquisition like Facebook, Google, and things from that nature, but also some direct mail. It's funny as it sounds, because of its laundry, there was a lot more acceptance and it was super cheap for us. And we target like a specific zones. So we didn't target everywhere. We target like a specific streets. We know the population type and things from that nature. It was like pennies per maybe like less than 20 cents per brochure. And then the conversion was pretty good. And regarding bigger businesses, if the B2B, it's a lot more of like sending emails. a lot of them are actually looking for services like that. And what they need is a convenience. So I would say the trick here is to talk about the problem. Like in anything you sell, if you talk to the customer about the solution, they're going to get overwhelmed. But if you talk to them about the problem, that's what helps us. And the moment we even on the B2C, when we talked about, like, even I remember we did a Subway campaign in New York, which was super expensive for us, but all of the team was about binge watching Netflix over the weekend and mimosas on Sundays, like talking about what they're missing. So they realize, wow, yes, I still find myself over the weekend, try to find my local or do myself a thing. So we remind them the problem, not necessarily what are we doing. I guess this approach really helped us in terms of growing, emphasizing on the problem side.
For sure. So what would you say is the one biggest piece of advice that you wish you knew before you started this company?
Yeah, wow. It's hard to say to one, but I guess I'm also doing a course right now. I'm transferring a course for others on product market fit. And I guess that's the biggest lesson, that product market fit is an ongoing phase, an ongoing process. And a lot of companies think, oh, we hit product market fit. That's amazing. We also hit a product market fit pretty soon, but then it's not a one point in time, right? And a lot of people forget about it. A lot of entrepreneurs and founders, and they kind of like, oh, I found a formula that is working, but the market is not staying static. Things are changing. Think about it. If Netflix at the beginning were killing Blockbuster, then Torrent and Pirate Bay and things like that came, and then they need to compete to a whole different level. So then they come as a streaming service. So they needed to change the game. And I feel like a lot of startups are too much focusing on keeping the existing instead of like looking strategically that product market fit is not one point in time. And that also hurt us because we didn't react fast enough for the changes. So I would say that probably was one of our biggest challenges. We overcome it, but you know, there is an opportunity cost. So I would think about, that's probably the biggest advice in terms of growing a company, because product market fit, so startup equal growth. And in order to hit exponential growth, you have to have product market fit. So it means that product market fit is everything, right? And a lot of people forget about it. And product market fit is, like I said, it's not one point in time. This is why it's always need to be in your mind. And if it's not, as the founders, so that you're probably not focusing on the right things.
For sure. So yeah, I mean, that's very good advice. Like if somebody watching this wanted to reach out to you, do you mind sharing your website or best way to get in contact with you?
Sure. I'm probably going to share the link to my personal website. There you can find a course that I'm doing on product market fit. I'm doing also one-on-one, and I have some other information like a blog and things from that nature that you can check out.
Awesome. Well, Itai, thank you so much for your time today. We're rooting for you. And yeah, thanks again.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure having you.
Likewise. Thanks. All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.